Good afternoon and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Today we are going to continue our series of conversations with the candidates. I'm speaking with the major candidates in the Democratic primaries for Baltimore mayor and city council president, congressional candidates in the 3rd, 6th, and 2nd district, and the leading candidates who are running for the U.S. Senate on both the Democratic and Republican sides. All of these interviews are posted on the Midday webpage. My guest today is Tharu Vignaraja, who is running in the Democratic primary for mayor of Baltimore. This is his 4th try for public office. He ran for Baltimore State's attorney in 2018, and he ran for Baltimore mayor in 2020. He ran again for state's attorney in 2022, and now he's running for mayor once again in a field that includes 12 other candidates. That's a crowded field, but it's about half the number of candidates who ran the last time. Mr. Vignaraja served as a federal prosecutor at the U.S. Attorney's Office in Baltimore. He also headed the Major Investigations Unit in the Baltimore State's Attorney's Office, and he was the Deputy Attorney General for Maryland for about 2 years. He was a partner at the law firm DLA Piper, and last year he served as the CEO of Capital Plus Financial, a community development financial institution that works to close the wealth gap for people of color. And in January of this year, Mr. Vignaraja was named the managing partner of the Baltimore office of the national law firm Sanford Heisler Sharp. Mr. Vignaraja is 47 years old. He attended Yale University and Harvard Law School, where he served as president of the Harvard Law Review. He was also a clerk for Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. Tharu Vignaraja joins me in Studio A. You are welcome to join us as well. If you have a question or comment for him, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. Mr. Vignaraja, welcome back. Good to talk to you.
Great to be back. Thanks for having me, Tom.
So we've been through this before, you and me, and you and a lot of other people.
Love it every time.
Yeah. So what's different this time?
Yeah, look, you know, there's a couple of things that we are very affirmatively going to do differently. One of the things that we're going to do differently is we are going to build a ground game the likes of which this city has never seen. The truth is, Tom, as an outsider running, it's hard to break in. In the last couple of campaigns, we had to rely on raising a lot of money and trying to, you know, crowd the airwaves. We actually have a base of people that know us because of the work we've done in the community, whether it was fighting against BG&E in the regulator dispute, whether it's standing up for people that have lost homes in tax sales. I think over the last couple of years, people have seen that I'm there fighting each and every time. The other big piece of it is not only that we have some name recognition, you know, 4 years ago, 2 years ago, people barely knew who Tharu Vignaraja was. It's also that this field lends itself to an outsider in a way that 4 years ago was very, very tough. It was an open primary, you know, 6 major candidates. I waited, obviously, to see what this field would look like. When it became clear that the debate that was unfolding in Baltimore was this debate between which is the lesser of two evils, you know, corruption or incompetence, I decided that was not a debate worthy of this city. And it provides a lane for change that isn't always there.
In 2018, when you ran for state's attorney, you got about 18,000 votes. It was 22% of the vote. In 2020, you were running for mayor. Again, that's the race that had these 24 people running, as you mentioned, 6 or so major candidates. You got 17,000 votes. And then a couple of years ago in 2022, when you ran for state's attorney in the race that Ivan Bates eventually won, you got 25,000-plus votes for that. The winner of the mayoral race in the race when you got 17,000 votes won it with 44,000 votes. Yeah. That's a big gap. So you're talking about what you're going to do differently in terms of the ground game, and then the field is a little bit different. But is there something that you can point to that's the reason that you have not been able to break through so far?
Yeah, look, I think there's two things. And I would first note that you'll observe that as an outsider, person who's never held public office like that, those totals go up each year, right? Each of those in those races, the number is growing because I do think we have people that learn about us for the first time. You know, they know who the city council president is, they know who the mayor is, but this guy who is a former federal prosecutor, a deputy attorney general, notwithstanding all of the public work that we have done, people who don't pay attention to politics closely, we grow that number each year. But I think the big difference in the past is twofold. One, in each of those races, there was a point when it felt like we had momentum and we were leading. 4 years ago, January of 2020, we had a lead in an independent poll. We'd raised more money than anyone else. And 2 weeks later, Mary Miller got in the race, dropped a lot of her own money, and it changed the dynamics of the race significantly. And she ended up being third. 2 years ago, we had a real lead. And in both of those races, a ton of negative advertising dollars were spent attacking us. Some of those attacks were unfair and untrue. Some of those attacks were fair. And one of the things that we're not going to allow to happen in this race is for allow our political opponents and the media, not you, but others, to try to define who we are. These are things that I perhaps wasn't ready to talk about in the past that I am ready to talk about now. I think that is part of the answer, is to not allow these negative attacks to do such damage when nobody really knows who you are because you're not established. The other thing that I think is very different is because we have this foundation, being able to say, I'm not Sheila Dixon. I didn't, you know, just leave the office in disgrace. I'm not Brandon Scott. I'm not the sort of face of this function of City Hall. Being able to say we have a clear, good alternative, we didn't have that chance 4 years ago. And I think that dynamic allows that leap. I mean, you're talking about, you know, a significant number of votes, but there are people that jump. You know, Brandon Scott was polling at 8 or 9% at this time 4 years ago, and he ended up winning with 29%. Last election, we got 30% of the vote. So just as a share, I think we're now in the mix in a way that we haven't been in before.
Tharu Vignaraja is my guest. He's a Democratic candidate for mayor in the mayoral primary that's happening in May. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. And just like with Sheila Dixon, who held office from 2010 to 2013, people bring up the fact that she left office in disgrace. People very concerned about her ethics. You mentioned attacks that, you know, have come up in all three of the previous races. You say some of the attacks are fair. One of them has to do with your management style, the way you treat people who work for you. There were some very damning text messages that a former employee shared with members of the press, showing some, you know, really belligerent and you know, just ungracious and inconsiderate behavior on your part. So when we say
you're being gracious in describing it that way,
well, yeah, it was to say the least, yeah, right? Yeah. Yeah. So where should we put those incidents in your life? Where should we put those incidents in the life of Sheila Dixon, for that matter?
Look, let me answer for myself. It's a fair question. It's a hard question. It's a hard question to talk about. And in some respects, it deserves more than the time that a radio interview allows. But let me start here. 10 years ago, when I was Deputy Attorney General, I was a very young manager. And I was a very demanding boss. I had very high expectations, and I pushed people as hard as I thought they needed to be pushed. But I was also a junior manager who had a lot to learn about how to inspire and how to motivate people, how to get the best out of them. It was also a rough time for me personally. My ex and I had just split up. It was a time when I thought that mental health and depression were not things that affected successful, smart people. That wasn't true. It was a hard season for me. Some of what you're describing was in the context of some complicated personal dynamics. I was the supervisor. It was my responsibility. It was my mistake, and I regret it. But through the past several years, 5 or 6 years, I have worked through a lot of this, professional development, therapy. I've become comfortable talking about the fact that I've had to wrestle with these demons. And I think I've emerged not just a better manager, but a better friend, a better person, a better leader. A mentor of mine, Tom, gave me this piece of scripture. I was raised in the Hindu tradition, but he thought it would be helpful. And it said, in crushing misfortune, be patient, for in fire gold is tested, and worthy men in the crucible of humiliation. I didn't know fully what it meant when I read it, but over time, it has been a source of guidance and strength. What it means to me is that when you've had this successful career, sometimes you need to be humbled. Sometimes you need to be humiliated. You need to be brought down and understand what's at stake and build back up. I think I have done that. You know, these things happened 10 years ago, but in the last two elections, I wasn't comfortable talking about them. I talked about them with friends maybe, but not certainly on the radio or with strangers. But here I am ready to address them because I think I'm in a place where I'm a better manager, a better leader. I think I'm more equipped to be our mayor today. And everybody has had those dark seasons. I had mine. I've gone through it. It is something I continue to work for. There are profound regrets that come from that era, but that is not who I am at my core, and it is certainly not the leader I know I am capable of being.
Having processed the crucible of humiliation, how does that make you the best suited in this particular field of candidates to manage a sprawling city government, a $4.5 billion budget? It's a lot of chickens to herd.
Yeah, look, you know, the city of Baltimore really is a failing multi-billion dollar corporation in need of a turnaround CEO. And when turnaround CEOs come in, they don't fire all 12,000 people. The approach I might have taken as a 35, 36-year-old deputy attorney general is not actually what turnaround CEOs do. They come in and they bring in two or three strong deputies, typically a couple from the outside, one from the inside. And they identify the 250, 300 most significant middle management roles. They identify the folks that are strong and they reinforce them and they give them raises. And they identify the folks that need to go and they shuffle those and find and recruit great people for them. The crucible of humiliation taught me that the way you do that is with an appreciation that not everyone is suited for every job, not everyone is ready for that job, but you don't need to fire them on a Friday before Christmas. What you should do is understand that they need time to get their effects in orders. So we need a turnaround CEO, but a turnaround CEO who's sort of been through the toughest parts and has come out, I think, stronger is more equipped to do this. But be clear, it is not just the tough seasons. It is also the fact that I'm really proud of the things that I've been able to do. I was a federal and city prosecutor. I was deputy attorney general. I know crime and law in a way that I don't think anybody else does. I was the CEO for 3 years of the largest CDFI in America, over $1 billion of revenue. We invested tens of millions in affordable housing, climate finance, impact real estate. I understand how to build and how the economy works. And I've also worked in the community day in and day out. It's not easy. I know it might seem it. It's not easy after you lose to brush off the sting, to brush off the hurt pride and say, I'm going to still try to help. I'm still going to try to do something. You know, when they call you, what you want to say is, look, I'm not the mayor. You voted for someone else. Call him. And often they would say back to me, we did. And they said nothing could be done. That's what happened in the BG&E case. That's what happened in these tax sale cases. And I have tried to understand that doing that work outside of a campaign, not when you're running, not when you're even thinking about running. A couple years ago, I probably would have told you 3 months, 6 months after the race that I would never do it again. But I did want to do the work in the community. And then I found myself realizing that I love this work. I love this opportunity to serve. It's what I want to do. I don't want to run for Congress. Congress seems like a hot mess. I don't want to be the governor of a prosperous state. I want to be the mayor of a broken city. This is my life's goal. Being a prosecutor, I was good at it. Being a lawyer, it was my career. But this is my calling.
But people would say, you want to be the mayor, but you also want to be the state's attorney twice. Yeah. You know, well, I mean, it's hard to know. I mean, it's people I think are concerned that you just want to be something.
Tom, no disrespect. I was something. I've been something. I've been president of the Harvard Law Review. I've been deputy attorney general. I've had fancy jobs. I wrote a book at Brookings and went on a book tour with Justice Breyer. I've done those things. The theme of the things that I've done are they're all connected to Baltimore. Yes, I think there are four roles that can dramatically change the arc of Baltimore in a remarkably fast time period. The CEO of schools, the police commissioner, the DA, the state's attorney of Baltimore, and the mayor. Truth is that I'm not qualified to be CEO of schools. I'm not going to be appointed the police commissioner. I can barely shoot a gun. I ran for the two roles that I thought could make a dramatic impact. That is the common thread. If I ever run for lieutenant governor, like Brandon Scott did, if I ever run for, state assembly, then you could say through, it just seems like you want to get in the game. I want to make a difference in a magical and significant way. I want to spark the renaissance of the city. I want to help write the first chapter of the greatest turnaround story in American history. And those things are ambitious. Those are not, You know, those are not fancy titles, but they are ambitious. Don't get me wrong. But they are all rooted in this city that I think is in desperate need of change.
So the first email we have is from a listener named Mark. And when we talk about the crucible of humiliation, Mark is lining up all of the things that have been, you know, that have come up over the years that, in which you've yeah. run. What were you doing with that woman on Greenmount Avenue that led to an altercation with the police? What were you doing in that hotel room? Personal questions, certainly, but given the number of times you've been caught on camera in inappropriate situations, why would voters trust you in office, especially when taken with the reports of the way you treat coworkers? That's just like a list of all the stuff that people have talked about over the last 6 years.
Yeah.
So the trust issue, you know, the trust issue is central. And if, for example, anyone, you or anybody else, makes the case that Sheila Dixon simply can't be trusted because of her past behavior, how do people make that decision in regards to your candidacy?
Yeah, I mean, let's do two things. One, let's note that all of these things are from a very distant time and a difficult time. You know, being the target of an arch conservative undercover operation with a woman,
Project Veritas,
when we were fully confirmed that nothing inappropriate or unethical happened, you know, that was a very hard chapter. It was a humiliating chapter. You know, my ex and I had to sort of, you know, be public about the state. That was very, very hard. But there was no wrongdoing there. There were no charges. Nobody filed a bar grievance. I think the office confirmed that. But let me be clear about the second piece. The Greenmount traffic stop was exactly what political opponents did when we were leading in the polls and had the most money of anyone before Mary Miller got in. Let me be crystal clear about how untrue that was. I was with a very dear friend, an accomplished lawyer, giving a tour while she was visiting Baltimore. I've given that tour many times. We got pulled over because I had a broken taillight that had been fixed, but that the repair order hadn't been sent in, resulting in a tag violation.
But the tour was happening at 1 o'clock in the morning.
Oh,
what kind of tours happen at 1
o'clock
in the morning?
Tom, I want to be clear, and I'll give you a dozen people. I want to show Baltimore the best and the worst of it. And I absolutely love showing this city in all of its glory. When people say, Theroux, why were you driving on Greenmount at midnight? My answer is, you know, people live there, right? There are people that call that home.
And I'm not talking about you're putting yourself in harm's way. I'm talking about having a so-called business meeting with a person
you describe
as a dear friend at 1 o'clock in the morning. And the minute this happened, she, you know, grabbed an Uber and got out.
No, Tom, this is important. Go watch the video. She didn't get out immediately. The traffic stop was 55 minutes long. After we waited for about 35, 40 minutes is when we finally decided to call her an Uber. We got permission from the officer. We provided the Baltimore Sun and anyone who wants the Uber receipts back to her hotel. This is exactly what we're talking about. The suggestion by our opponents that this was some street worker who jumped out of the car. It's just
not
true.
Well, I'm not suggesting that.
No. Well,
but I am suggesting that it's a strange judgment to make. For a man I know to be a very smart guy, you know, it's a strange judgment to make to be at 1 o'clock in the morning supposedly showing somebody around the neighborhood.
Tom, No. I'm not showing her the neighborhood. I'm showing her Baltimore. Why was I on Greenmount in particular? Why was I in that particular block? It's because that's where we prosecuted the BGF. This is one of the most high-profile homicides in Baltimore history, one of the most big, important takedowns. This was 24th and Barkley, where we indicted 48 people. It resulted in an 18-month period where we didn't have a single murder. I take folks there to show the kinds of things that we have done. I took a Stanford law professor who is a student and professor of urban studies on exactly that tour a week earlier.
In the middle of the night?
Absolutely. And you know, Michelle has offered to share this. I've done this probably a dozen times, and I think you're missing something. The reason you do it when there's not everyone around is to understand that these are where people live, that these broken neighborhoods are as broken. They're not bustling during the day. They're open-air drug markets during the day, but they're places where some people do get nervous. I'm not nervous in any part of my city. I love giving that tour. And yes, it goes through Federal Hill. It goes through Fort McHenry. But we also take them to Old Town Mall. And I pull out at 10 p.m.
on the east side,
the photo of Martin Luther King in his Cadillac driving through the middle of that bustling Old Town Mall. And then I show them the haunted house that it is today. I'm not scared there, but if you came upon me at Old Town Mall at 10 p.m., you might say, what are you doing there? Tom, totally your call if you don't want to do those tours there. And I understand that people don't. I am comfortable doing it. I'm proud to do it. I think some of the people that have come to town, including dignitaries that I won't identify, have asked to do this tour because they've heard about it. And when I share it with them, they say, you seem to really love this city and all of its glory and all of its shame. And that is exactly right.
And we'll talk about crime, in particular violence reduction, on the other side of a quick break. It's the latest installment in our series of conversations with the candidates. My guest is Thiru Vignaraja, who's running in the May 14th Democratic primary for mayor of Baltimore. You can join our conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
I'm Al Waller.
I'm Catherine Collinson.
And I'm Mihaela Vince.
In upcoming episodes of Clear Path, Your Roadmap for Life, we'll discuss ways to catch up on retirement savings and the importance of self-care. Tune in to WYPR's website and mobile app, all major podcast platforms, and transamericainstitute.org.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, a recap of the Super Tuesday primaries that are taking place today in 16 states with E.J. Dion, a syndicated columnist with The Washington Post, plus a conversation with developer Tim Reagan and Center for Urban Families founder Joe Jones about the Touchpoint Empowerment Center at Mondawmin Mall. So that's coming up tomorrow. If you've just joined us today, it's another installment in our series of conversations with the candidates. My guest is Thiru Vignaraja, a former assistant U.S. attorney who's once again running in the Democratic primary for Baltimore mayor. Thiru Vignaraja joins me here in Studio A. You are welcome to join us as well. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. We have a call from Tola, who evidently is calling from the UK. Tola, welcome to Midday with Thiru Vignaraja.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Thiru. This is Tola calling from the UK. I think the issue of trust is really important, but I wanted to point out that why are we focusing on a private individual who was driving their car around town? I don't understand why there's a trust issue there. I mean, it's none of anyone's business why somebody might be driving around a different part of town at night, especially if they weren't accused of committing a crime. I think the major trust issue is with leadership that have continually, have corrupt practices, ethical issues, and former Mayor Dixon actually committed a crime.
All right. Well, thank you for that perspective, Tola. I appreciate it. We touched on this a little bit before the break, and I want to give you a chance to respond. How should people judge Sheila Dixon's ethical posture at this point, 13 years after she held office before? And should that metric, the metrics used to judge Ms. Dixon's ethics, Mr. Scott's ethics for that matter, and yours be the same?
Yeah, sure. Listen, I want to be clear about something I was talking about in the context of Green Mountain. I appreciate the call from Tola. The critical part to acknowledge is the parts where I know I did wrong and I have worked to be the kind of leader that I want to be. The reason we're going back and forth about Green Mount is because I don't think I did anything wrong there. I should have not been snippy with the police officer, no question. I was frustrated. This tour started after dinner. I was tired. But the distinction is the pattern. What I think people have forgotten about Sheila Dixon is that it wasn't just the gift cards. She was, she finished up O'Malley's last year, 9 months there. She took the oath, and after 6 months, her house was raided by the FBI. 6 months later is when she was indicted. She was mayor for a minute, and they were investigating things that had been going on for years. People have forgotten about the funds that she gave to her sister Then she fired her sister. She went over to a company. The sister then was getting money from the city, and Ms. Nixon didn't disclose that her sister was there. Then there was a developer. Then there's my concern with Ms. Nixon is that she has represented that it was just gift cards in the context of a personal relationship when there was so much more. The other concern that I have is it's been a long time and our problems are so much more complicated. I don't want you to vote for Tharu Vignaraja over Sheila Dixon just on the trust issue. I want you to understand that our problems are vast. And the problems that Sheila Dixon is most famous for, picking up the trash, yes, that's one of them. But we have a lot more complex problems in this city today than when she took over in 2007, 2009. This is a very different city. And unlike me, who has sort of stayed involved in the work every day, fighting for people, taking on BGE, standing up when nobody else would stand up, Ms. Dixon's been running for the last 10 years, too. I mean, this is her third mayoral election. And I can't point to something, a piece of legislation that she's advocated for, a cause that she's taken up, a big donor or developer that she has stood up for. She's silent on Harbor Place, one of the most important decisions of the next mayor, and has basically said, I'm going to let this happen.
Well,
That's a problem.
We'll let her talk about those when we talk to her next. But I do want to talk to you about violence reduction.
Yeah.
Because in the last mayoral campaign, far and away, I mean, all the polling showed 90% of people thought the single most important issue was violence reduction and public safety. So Brandon Scott won that election in the primary and the general election with a promise to reduce violence. And it's a promise that he has largely kept, has he not? I mean, 68 fewer people were killed in 2023 than had been killed in 2022. That's still too many people losing their lives to homicide, but a lot fewer people have been killed. It's just that simple. And his plan, his approach to this, the group violence reduction strategy, has been validated by a number of criminal justice experts, people who study this thing. They say if you're going to do it, that's the way to do it. I mean, I've talked to many of these folks.
Yep.
What is your assessment of the group violence reduction strategy? And if you are elected, does that stay in place or do you nuke that and start with something else?
Well, let's be crystal clear on what that is. That label, group violence reduction strategy, is basically go after gangs and large drug organizations, take them off the streets, and make sure that they are warned about the risk of this beforehand.
It's not gangs. It's not gangs.
It's groups.
People, it's people who are involved and connected to other people either in their neighborhood or in their sphere.
Yeah, I mean, we can give it.
We're not on MS-13 all the time.
But we are talking about sets of the Black Guerrilla Family. We are talking about the up the hill crew and the down the hill crew. We're talking about crews that operate together, typically selling drugs and doing violence. And David Kennedy, who pioneered this in New York, a dear friend, absolutely right. It is what we were doing when we got murders below 200. 100%. It is appropriate strategy. But this is a little bit of the rooster taking credit for the dawn. And I want to make sure you're an excellent journalist. You know what Brandon Scott's pledge was. His pledge was a 15% reduction in homicides each year for 4 years. He didn't reach it the first year. He didn't reach it the second year. He did reach it the third year. But 2023 was a good year across the country. Take aside Washington, D.C., the one city that saw a spike in crime. Every other major city in America, Tom, saw a dramatic reduction in homicides. Detroit saw its lowest homicide since 1966.
That's absolutely true. But on the other hand, 2021 and 2022 saw spikes in every major city in the country.
Well, that's because we were...
It's all going up and down nationally.
But Tom, that's where we were already at the peak. We already had a murder rate that was way off the charts. Look this up. 2023, when we went down, the thing we're celebrating, the thing that the mayor is taking credit for, which is also happening in Detroit and Philadelphia and Chicago and Los Angeles and St. Louis, in 2023, the year we're celebrating, Baltimore was still the second deadliest major city in America. Second. It was still exactly in its position.
So does your plan then call for abandoning
the
approach? I mean, because when I look at your very, very complete, you've got, I don't know, you had a 4 years ago, I think you had a 280-point plan to end violence, but it includes things like wiretap investigations, aerial surveillance, ground cameras, those kinds of things, that there are a lot of people, you know, worried about civil liberties there. They're worried about privacy issues. They're worried about over-incarceration. They're worried about a lot of things. And I just wonder if this holistic approach that Brandon Scott is, in fact, taking care of, taking credit for, and maybe it's the rooster taking credit for the dawn, but it's also, you know, something he can point to numbers that show that it's effective to a certain extent.
Respectfully, Tom. Brandon Scott first started by talking about his first plan, which is about increases in license plate readers. And then he had a second plan about focusing on specific geographies. Then there was a third plan. Each 6 months, there was literally, go look, each 6 months there was a new unveiling of a crime plan. And then group violence reduction strategy, which was his latest, happened to coincide with a dramatic reduction. That has absolutely got to be a cornerstone of our approach. We will absolutely continue with going after groups of people that are committing violent offenders. That's what the wiretaps are for. That's what the undercover operations that you're referencing in the plan are for. I have never advocated, not once in my 6 years, a return to zero tolerance or mass incarceration. But we also can't have zero enforcement. We absolutely, you know, you listed ideas from one column, but you, if you continued reading, of course, the other column are things like lifting the burden off of returning citizens, where we suspend their driver's license and garnish 50% of their wages unless they pay their state debt back. That is a terrible albatross that we put around their neck. It's partnering with faith organizations to make sure that we can get paths to constructive employment. It is diversion programs for juveniles and low-level offenders. It's expanding the district court reentry project. This is a holistic
approach.
Can
be done. Those can be implemented while keeping safe streets and Roca and Muncie. And, you know, how about the personnel? Do we keep Rich Worley as the police commissioner? Do we keep Stephanie Mavronis as the director of the mayor's office of neighbor safety and engagement? Do we keep, you know, people who are currently in these unelected positions?
Tom, you know, the responsible thing for me to do is to have a conversations with each of these individuals. I don't know Stephanie well, but I've met her in passing. She seems, you know, like a very talented woman. Rich Worley, I knew him as a major. I thought he was a terrific major. I think that there are things that I hope he can get on board with. I don't have any objections to him. There are police commissioners that I've had concerns with, but importantly, I have never said it is the commissioner's fault that crime is going down. You don't blame the CEO of schools or the police commissioner or the head of housing for your failures. Mayor LaGuardia famously said, if a pigeon dies in Central Park, it's my responsibility. That's not the approach we have here. We blame the state. We blame the feds. We say this person's got to go. Ultimately, if crime doesn't go down, blame me. If the schools don't get better, blame me. Rich Worley is a part of our team, and I want to have a conversation with him and anyone else who wants to contribute to the turnaround of this city. But those things can coexist, and this false choice between, you know, law enforcement doing its job and reforming the system is just that, a false
choice.
And
I ask because one of the points that folks have made, not just Brandon Scott, but others, is that we've ping-ponged from different approaches every 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, and that there's no consistency, and that the consistency is one of the things that perhaps can lead to, you know, to more success. So that's what's behind that question.
I think the question one should ask is, if there was a silver bullet that Brandon Scott has used, why didn't it have any difference in the first year or the second year of his administration? Why is it that it coincided with the same year that there was a national reduction? You know what the criminologists say? It's because we're far enough away from COVID. And why Baltimore didn't spike was because we were already at the spike. We had already had in 2015 this dramatic increase from just below 200 to 350. So there's actually some pretty sound explanations for the national trends. I absolutely want to build on the work that we have done. I don't think you go in, just as I said, you don't go in and fire everyone. You have sensible adult conversations, as leaders do, with the folks that need to stay and the folks that need to turn the page.
All right. We have a number of callers who want to get in on our conversation, which we'll do. Let's go to Juliana, who's calling from Baltimore. Welcome to Midday with Thiru Vignaraja.
Hi. Thank you so much for allowing me to call in and have a voice. I just want to first off say Thiru Vignaraja is a friend of mine. I met him back when he originally ran for mayor, but I just got wind of his candidacy towards the end. I have a marketing background, and I just thought, well, and I'm a younger person, and I just wanted to use my energy and voice to, like, really get out there and help him.
Do you have a question you want to ask on behalf of everybody else who's listening? Delighted to have you on the show.
So, okay, I know you're quick to the point, but give me one moment. If you just give me 2 minutes.
Two minutes ain't going to happen. Juliana, 2 minutes isn't going to happen. But if you have a question, we'd be glad to take that. What is your question?
Right now, sorry, Tom. So we said 15% each year for Brandon Scott with his, crime reduction. Why is there not a plan on a yearly basis? It's on a day-to-day basis. Why are we saying it's a 15% reduction? We're not hitting those numbers for 1 to 2 years.
Okay, Juliana, I'm sorry, but since there isn't a real question in there, we're going to move on. Let's go to Sean calling in Pikesville. Sean, welcome to the show.
Yes, hi, Tom. I wanted to ask he's a friend of mine as well, A. Thuru. There are many communities that have complained about the flawed and discriminatory rollout of complete streets, as well as DOT's advantage to bike more, rails the trails, by giving these groups seats at the table, and communities are being marginalized. Now, bike more has stooped to an all-time low of attempting to silence and intimidate one of our senior black female activists by doxing her and lying on her by calling her anti-bike and anti-auto-complete streets. This isn't true. Now, here's my question, Thuru. How will you correct DOT's missteps and address the misconduct of Bike More as they attempt to buy and influence city politics?
All right, thanks for the question, Sean. You know, bikes and transportation, a big issue.
Yeah, look, I mean, public transit is a critical feature of what the mayor has to focus on. And in 2017, we laid out a commitment to add 77 miles of bike lanes. And actually what is being referenced is one of the reasons we can't get there, because we actually never did the important work of getting community input and community dialogue in certain communities where there is going to be resistance. The truth is that the most livable cities in the world have comprehensive bike networks. They have free public transit. We've committed to expanding the free circulator to east-west routes, to making sure within the first 60 days we have a free circulator bus on Edmondson Avenue to Franklin Street to Orleans to Pulaski, from Park Heights to North Avenue up Harford Road. Those are the kinds of commitments that we have to make. And if there is misconduct or intimidation, of course the mayor has to address that and make sure that's not part of the conversation. And the biggest reason why is because everybody should be committed to expanding our public transit, bikes, free buses, all of these things. And when these things get caught up in the local politics, when there's a racial dimension that is added to them, it actually interferes with our ability to do something that a great city has to do.
My guest is Thuru Vignaraja. He's running in the Democratic primary for mayor of Baltimore. We'll have more with Thuru Vignaraja after a quick break. To join us, we're at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And this programming note for next Tuesday, a week from today, we'll hold another midday town hall with Governor Wes Moore. The governor will answer my questions and yours a week from today here on Midday. If you have a question that you'd like to pose to the governor, you can send us an email to midday@wipr.org, or you can call our listener line to record a message that will play on the air. That number, 410-735-1616. Again, 410-735-1616. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
I'm Al Waller.
I'm Catherine Collinson.
And I'm Mihaela Vince.
In upcoming episodes of Clear Path, Your Roadmap for Life, we'll discuss ways to catch up on retirement savings and the importance of self-care. Tune in to WYPR's website and mobile app, all major podcast platforms, and transamericainstitute.org.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, it's the latest installment in our series of Midday Conversations with the Candidates. My guest is Thiru Vignaraja. He's running for mayor of Baltimore in a Democratic primary field that includes the incumbent, Brandon Scott, former mayor Sheila Dixon, and businessman Bob Wallace. You can find my conversations with those folks on the Midday page at WIPR.org. Thiru Vignaraja is with me here in Studio A. You can be with us too, 410-662-8780, our email midday at WIPR.org. So last night, the city council passed a series of bills clearing the way for David Bramble and MCB Partners, the real estate company that he runs, to move forward with their plan for Harbor Place. You've been vocal about your opposition to that plan. What should we be doing, given the fact that that legislation proposed by Councilman Costello has now passed? It will go, part of it will go to the voters because there's a charter amendment that has to be passed by the voters. Given where we are now and where the plans are now, which include a 900 apartments right on the water there at what is now the Light Street Pavilion, what do you think we should, where should we go from here?
Everybody wants to see the revival of Harbor Place. And the truth is that it needs to be part of a public dialogue about what we're doing as a broader city, about where we're going to make our investments. The truth is that, like Cleveland did at the beginning of the ARPA funds, they developed a master plan for what they wanted to commit to. What they are proposing at Harbor Place is just terrible. I've been very vocal in my opposition. I'm the only candidate.
Because of the apartment building and blocking the views?
The notion that we're going to take dedicated public space and construct two luxury apartments, 32 floors, 25 floors on the promenade that is ours is, and I put it in a tweet, I said it was a colossal sinful mistake. And somebody responded and said, oh my God, I had no idea Thiru was such a, so dramatic, a drama queen, I think. And I said, no, this is what James Rouse's son, Ted Rouse, said was the most precious waterfront property in America. It is ours, and the notion that we're going to give it away to developers to make their economics, you know, more profitable, I think it's shameful. What we should have done is had a true public dialogue where a master plan was developed for the entire area and specifically for the Inner Harbor. That's what Vancouver did with Cole Harbor, Sydney did with the Sydney Opera House, New York City did with the High Line. And then you present it to the public, you get input, you ratify it. Then you ask an international competition. You ask the best architects and urban planners in the world to come up with their visions for our master plan. And you select one, a blue ribbon commission selects one. And then at the very end of the process, developers bid for that privilege. What am I going to do?
Of course, that didn't happen.
It didn't happen.
You're exactly right. Maybe that would
have
been
great. Here's what I'm
going to do. Because what happened was it went into receivership. You know, the gem of the Baltimore downtown, the center of city life, went into receivership. And they found a guy, a local guy, who's certainly committed to the city, who wants to buy it and fix it. And for him to fix it and make it financially viable, he needs those apartments to make the money work.
I just don't believe it. And Tom, if you had actually suggested to a long line of folks that we were prepared to invest $400 million in public subsidies to repair the infrastructure around it and that we might lift the height restrictions or allow the commercialization of that, I promise you there would have been a line around the block trying to get that building. Instead, you had this deal where Dave Bramble gets it in a no-bid situation and now gets these massive concessions. It is just shameful that we have allowed this to unfold. And I'm going to be very frank about it. I'm the only candidate that is prepared to do this. We're going to block the construction by executive order of luxury apartments in any public park, which includes the Inner Harbor Public Park. You wouldn't do it in Central Park because the economics are necessary. You wouldn't do it in Druid Hill or Clifton Park. Somebody comes and says, well, Leakin Park's going to be a lot better if we have some commercialization of it. That is not a reason to give away our public space. It's just too bad. And it's not an accident that we're also the only campaign that is committed to taking public financing. It's the first time it's been available in Baltimore. No one can contribute more than $150. We can't take money from PACs or developers or corporations. So the tens of thousands of dollars that have lined the pockets of my opponents that specifically have approved and are on board with this plan, it's no accident that we're also the only ones that have said, nope, we're taking this money out of politics. And if you go to theroofermayor.com, you have a chance to contribute to the first time that Baltimore's ever allowed public financing. I'm so proud of it. I've been advocating it for it since I was a debater in college, and it's here, it's important, and it's why we can distinguish ourselves in so many ways.
The last time you ran, a lot of your financing came from the Smith family, who owned Sinclair Broadcasting. Members of the family donated the maximum. You appeared on Fox 45 continually. Why is it, can you explain why it is that it seems that the Smith family and Sinclair Broadcasting seems to be promoting the candidacy of Sheila Dixon this time? David Smith contributed $100,000 to a PAC that is there for Sheila Dixon. Why their change of heart this time? Well, do you have any explanation for
let's
that?
Let's put in context that we had, unfortunately, the necessary evil of having to raise money from wealthy people. And we had 135 max out donors. I think the Smiths were one of a lot of people that actually made a lot of big checks. The truth is that I tried to build relationships with every media outlet. As an outsider, I've gotten to know you, Tom. I've gotten to know a lot of folks. I thought it was important.
You've been on this show a lot.
Yeah, I think it's important to actually be able to connect with people that have a chance to talk to the folks. And anytime, I've always taken the position, I will attend every debate to which I am invited. I will attend every forum. I've never declined an invitation from any media outlet. And at the end of the day, there are certain individuals, and I'm not going to identify, you know, particular donors or particular families, that believe that their best chances are with having people that follow their instructions. I'm not one of those people. And Carl Stokes, I think, is the one who told the world.
Were you one of them 4 years ago?
Absolutely not. And there were lots of questions that I was asked on Fox 45 town halls about dismantling safe streets, about firing the CEO of schools. I think I knew the answer that some people wanted there, and I never said, go back and look, that I would fire the CEO of schools or dismantle safe streets, because I don't think a candidate running for office should deliver answers because a donor or a developer or a station. Tom, I think I know the answers that sometimes you want to hear. I give you the answers that I think are best for the people of Baltimore. That has never changed. And I'm
by the way, I don't have any that I want to hear. I'm interested in what they are. And let me, because we're running out of time, in our last 30 seconds, talking about taxes, there's a group called Renew Baltimore that is going to probably have a ballot initiative in November to reduce property taxes by half in a period of, I think, 6 years. What's your position on that?
So 4 years ago, the former president of WYPR, as you remember, Tony Brandon, wrote an op-ed in the Baltimore Sun saying that our plan was the first plan that he had seen that was visionary and actionable. It was a plan to cut property taxes in half in 10 years, but it also had compensatory revenue mechanisms built in. My concern with the Renew approach is it's just a quick slash and hope the economics will recover. It's a little faster than I would like, and I worry about the cushion not being there. So in principle, we have to cut property taxes, but I think there's a righteous and responsible way of getting to where we need to go.
And that's all the time we have. I appreciate, as always, your coming by and engaging in conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Tharu Vignaraji is a Democratic candidate for mayor of Baltimore. The Democratic and Republican primaries are on May 14th. Early voting begins on May 2nd. If you're eligible but not yet registered, get registered. You can do that online or by mail by April 23rd. Our Conversations with the Candidates series continues later this week. On Friday, my guest will be Prince George's County Executive Angela Alsobrook. She's running in the Democratic primary for the U.S. Senate. That's it for us on this edition of Midday tonight at 8 o'clock. Stay tuned to WYPR for NPR's live coverage of the results of Super Tuesday primaries that are taking place across the country. And coming up tomorrow, E.J. Dion of the Washington Post will analyze those results with me here on Midday. Plus, we'll talk to Tim Reagan and the Center for Urban Families founder Joe Jones about their plans for the Touchpoint Empowerment Center at Mondawmin Mall. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it. Have a great day.
This is Baltimore's NPR News Station, 88.1 WYPR.